Hello and welcome to Low Society. Today I have a very special guest with me. I have Nina Power with me, who I am a huge fan of and have been for a while. And I'm so excited to talk to you today. But for those members of our audience who may not know you, could you introduce yourself?
Sure. I guess I'm a writer and teacher, but largely now outside of academia. I left the academy, the hallowed walls, a few years ago for various reasons. It wasn't me, it was them. So now I do a lot of teaching of adult education and also things in the post-academic and para-academic world, so largely online, teaching whatever I like to people who would like to think about things properly, which is much, much better than whatever is going on in those institutions.
Yes, so
I'm also recently a senior editor for Compact magazine, which you should all subscribe to. It's based in America, but it writes about geopolitics, and it's a kind of post-liberal, for want of a better word, magazine, and it's an attempt to bring people together who disagree, which is obviously largely forbidden in our stupid regime. So it features people who are left-wing, right-wing, centre, religious, non-religious, and so on, and the whole idea is that we actually talk about things that matter to people, and we try and think about the future together, and how we make things better for everybody.
Awesome. And yeah, I've been a huge fan of your writing for a long time, but specifically your book, What Do Men Want, which is really phenomenal and answered a lot of questions that I had about the current war that's raging between men and women, or the culture war that's raging between men and women, which is what I kind of brought you on to talk about today, because it's an area of great fascination, more so morbid fascination for me. So I guess my first question for you is, when did this tension first come to light for you? What was the sort of first cultural moment that brought it to your consciousness?
Yeah, I think probably there was a whole series of things that happened all at once, which, you know, that were a series of fake wars, I guess. Like, it's interesting you mentioned, like, the idea of war, because I think it is a culture war in the sense that it's imposed on reality and it's not reality. And I think it went along with that kind of turn towards identity politics, I guess, whatever you want to say. And I was a bit late noticing what was going on because I was tied up with some other activism, which I thought was more meaningful, which was to do with, like, making sure people didn't go to prison for protesting and stuff like that. And, like, we knew who our enemy was and it was, like, the state and the police and the courts. And then suddenly it turned out that no, like, we were the enemy. Men were the enemy. White people were the enemy. Cis people were the enemy. I don't know, whatever. So I think, in all seriousness, I think there was a whole kind of series of defeats. At least that was my experience in the UK, like following the student movement, for example. Like, we didn't win the fee battle, then had the English riots in 2011, which is a very interesting moment. And then I think somewhere around 2013 or 2014, I'm not really sure, this other sort of thing started coming in, and I don't really associate it with the left properly. It's not the left that I grew up with, and it doesn't have anything to do with forms of solidarity, which would include solidarity between men and women, for goodness sake. And if you look back at some of the early socialist feminists like Kollontai, you know, she makes it very clear that whatever issues there are between men and women, especially working class men and women, right, it's nothing compared to the solidarity that they have to have, right, when fighting together and trying to improve their existence in a vicious system. So I think we have to see all of these logics as fundamentally divisive, you know, because they blatantly are. So I wanted to write something that was deliberately and explicitly reasonable, which itself is sort of faintly provocative, you know. Like, had I written a book called I Hate Men — there is actually a book called I Hate Men, written by a French woman recently — but had I called it, like, you know, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on your podcast, but, you know, F men, you know, or you can, men are a bunch of I actually try not to swear. I have this like thing about it being very powerful, like, you know, it's magic, and of course it is, but anyway, but you know what I mean, had I written a book that was really polemical and that made, you know, that was really vicious towards men, it would have been promoted in a very different way, and it probably would have been more welcomed by certain sections. And you know, because people have a fantasy image of what they think like a feminist book on men must be today, and they assume that it would be, you know, just this kind of generalizing horror, which we've seen so much of. And I think basically I wanted to, you know, I'm older, I'm not in my 20s anymore, I'm in my 40s, and I wanted to write something that was true to my experience, right, which includes men like my father and my brother and male friends and partners, including, you know, former partners, you know, none of whom are evil, none of whom, you know, fit the image of men as we are supposed to accept it according to the liberal media. So I felt that, you know, that some of that rhetoric, the kind of anti-male stuff, was getting wildly out of hand. It doesn't account for class. You know, when we talk about deaths of despair and the opioid crisis in the US, or, you know, what happened to the former industrial areas in Britain, you know, these are tendencies that have, like, devastated, like, working class men, right? And the idea that somehow we need instead to talk about male privilege as if there's some kind of fundamental thing that's given to men is just not true.
So
I wanted to write something realistic and to try to sort of, you know, get, well, not just get away from, but radically oppose that divisive rhetoric. And I think, you know, some of the response I've gotten has been positive in the sense of people saying, well, I never believed that anyway. You know, like, I never thought that men were my enemy. And I'm like, yeah, great. You know, so I don't know where this kind of liberal divisive rhetoric is coming from, right? Because it isn't shared by the vast majority of people in their everyday life, you know, in our encounters. You know, it's not to say that all encounters we have with each other are good. Of course not. Like, social life is complicated. Like, we upset each other all the time. You know, people make mistakes. Most of it's unintentional, you know, but that's like, you have to live with that, you know. And women definitely make mistakes too. Definitely. Like, it's very important. Go on.
No, I was just gonna say, I sort of look at it as it sort of predates wokeness. It predates you know, the sort of liberal left milieu that currently exists. And I think that wokeness is kind of a vehicle for tensions that existed previously, ones that feminism failed to reckon with in terms of women's, you know, newfound autonomy, women's newfound freedom, and how we sort of take responsibility for those freedoms. I think sort of wokeness provided an area where those questions could be obfuscated by sort of creating a boogeyman, this all-encompassing threat to blame some of the tensions that women currently face, which have nothing to do with men. You could say they have a lot to do with sort of hangovers of, like, old patriarchal norms, but this impulse to blame all men, that's a completely different thing. And there's not a whole lot of intellectual sort of honesty in terms of how these things are discussed. And that was what I found so stimulating about your book, was it was sort of kind of bringing the question to light and also holding the current mode of liberal feminism accountable for the deleterious effect it's having. I mean, it is getting really bad, especially with the advent of social media. The way men and women talk about each other these days is steeped in such disdain, hatred, resentment. It's gotten to the point now where, you know, especially among young people, they're becoming almost sexless. Like, there's lower rates of sex, there's lower rates of relationships. it's becoming a disaster. But I guess my question to you is, where do you think the sort of origin of this is? Do you think it starts with the sort of liberal left milieu now, or do you think this is something that's far-reaching, sort of in the way that I do, something that started way back before any of the sort of modern manifestations?
That's a really good question. I mean, there's so many things that come to mind. It's just, I suppose, yeah, let me just begin, because I made a little series of words that I'm going to go through to get to your to answer your question. So first of all, yeah, like, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't say I want freedom to do whatever I like, but I'm also always the victim. Do you know what I mean? Like, freedom is also to fail and to, you know, and to take risks and so on. And, you know, obviously women like Paglia have made this point, but also the second wave were very clear, like even when they were writing about patriarchy, that women were not the victims, right? If patriarchy was something to be explained, right, and that's debatable, but when the second wave were talking about it, they were talking about it from the position of, you know, defending women's complicity in a system, if you like, or to trying to describe it, not simply say women are the guileless victims of men and they don't know what they're doing, you know, because that's to put women back into the category of something like animals or children, right? It's not to treat women as autonomous moral agents, let alone political agents. Mm-hmm. So I think that lots of chickens are coming home to roost at the moment. I think the sexual revolution, you know, we've had 60 years of a certain image of desire, the idea that, oh, desire is good because it's desire and sex is good because, you know, it's better that people have more sex. It's not necessarily good, if you see what I mean. And I do remember, like, I did psychoanalysis for 5 years, and there was one point I was saying, oh, I don't know, oh, I had sex with somebody and it was good, you know, because I had sex. And I remember my analyst going, why? Like, why is having sex a good thing? I was like, oh, yeah. You know, it's so deeply ingrained that, like, simply having sex must be a good thing, because in a way the sort of liberal permissive culture encourages to think that expressing ourselves in whatever way, but especially sexually, is somehow indicative of who we are. Like, it's almost like, you know, our being is to be a sexual being, and, you know, it's part of a journey or something like that, and it may not be at all. Like, it may be, like, more or less irrelevant. And I think the current wave of sex negativity is actually very interesting in this regard. I think there is a, I think it ties in with actually what I think is the collapse of patriarchy, because actually what's happened is that men and women have become really close. Like, they're competitors. They're basically like brother and sister. I try and say this a bit in the book, and then afterwards I wrote another article which went into more detail. But we're not, the patriarchy is like a fantasy. It's almost like some women want there to be a patriarchy so that they can rail against it. But in practice, what there is a load of brothers and sisters who are being forced to compete for jobs in the same market, do the same sort of shitty things, like go on dating apps. They end up sort of like, you know, being too close and not have the frisson of difference, which is what you need, actually, to fancy somebody.
Yeah.
So you end up with a kind of sexlessness, yeah, which might involve actually, yeah, it might involve having sex with lots of people, but it's absolutely meaningless sex, right? It's, if you speak to people who've used a dating app, so I've spoken to quite a few female friends, in the end, they feel devastated by them. You know, it's horrible. Like, It doesn't bring you closer. If, you know, if what people want is intimacy, this is not what's going on, you know. And the sexual revolution, that celebration of desire, of course, has just been completely captured by capitalism. It's like, yes, you can have whatever you want. You can eat 20 cakes a day if you've got the money. It's not good for you, but it doesn't matter because it's what you want, you know. So
exactly,
the sexual revolution
exactly
has failed, and we are in the, you know, the sort of counter-revolutionary period, and it's very interesting.
Definitely. And I think the response to it has been interesting on both sides of the political aisle. And it's really interesting that you bring up Paglia, who I'm like a big fan of. I don't always agree with her, but her work is electrifying. And one of the elements of it that really resonated with me the most was this idea of responsibility and how these different forms of politics that rise up around feminism are often sort of a way of absconding responsibility for the freedoms that we've asked for as women and fought for. And when you talk about the sexual revolution, that's sort of a prime example where you see this happening all the time. And a lot of the pain and anguish that women are feeling after, you know, using sex or having sex in ways that are counter to their feelings, their inner lives and things like that, is to then turn it out on men and blame men and call men the problem.
Yeah.
When the issue is around their sense of self, their sense of boundaries, their sense of self-esteem. And you see this all the time where modern feminism is now like an outlet kind of for alienated, misanthropic feelings. Mm-hmm. And like something almost akin to like Jungian animus possession in the sense that it's sort of adopting the most antisocial aspects of what we deem traditionally masculine attributes and sort of encouraging women to behave in that way, especially within the realm of like sexuality, for instance. And it does damage a lot of women. And there has been a huge cultural backlash in terms of like this sex negativity we're seeing. I'm still skeptical about both sides at the moment. I'm skeptical about both sides, but I am glad that counter narratives are emerging. Whether or not I agree with all of the counter narratives is another thing, but I'm glad that counter narratives are emerging and that that conversations are being had. What are your thoughts on the sex negativity movement and sort of its impact so far?
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, insofar as I understand it, right, I'm just going to respond on that basis. I mean, I think, first of all, it's absolutely worth noticing and paying attention to, right, because whether it's ultimately positive or negative, it definitely represents dissent from the now extraordinarily prevalent image of, you know, that desire is good, that I keep going on about, you know, that, and in that sense, It is absolutely symptomatic and kind of very important, right? Like it indicates a form of resistance to, you know, this overwhelming dominant cultural narrative that you must be sexy and you must have sex and sex is really important to who you are, and it isn't. Like, I don't think sex is that important. Like I don't know, it doesn't make you an interesting person. And lots of people have fallen for the trap that, oh, being transgressive sexually is a political statement. And it's not, you know, mm-hmm. it's
definitely,
it's not a political, it's not politically interesting.
Definitely.
You know, what's interesting is talking about philosophical ideas, right? That's what's interesting. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, that's much mm-hmm. better than sex. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, at least from my point of view. So, I think there's the sort of saturation of sex and the proximity of men and women has created a kind of ennui and a sort of like loathing. And I also think that, and this is the negative bit of the sex negativity aspect, maybe, would be the total dissociation of mind and body, which is completely encouraged by the internet, obviously, and the idea that you can have an identity that's mm-hmm. separate from your body and that you are not your body and all of that is mm-hmm, really bad, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that has, I think it also excessive porn use, particularly among young men, has meant that they are so dissociated from real sex, so that, you know, when you actually hold somebody or you have a body in your arms or even your own body, like you don't know how to deal with it, right? Because there's something too real and too visceral about actual body. So, but I think that's part of a bigger question about touch. And I try to talk about touch in the book and the way in which touch is being completely proscribed. And we obviously saw this during the lockdown. That whole tendency was completely extended and exacerbated. You know, the idea of touching somebody else was you know, like the most horrible thing you could do. And I think that's very bad. Like, it's very bad psychologically for people to feel untouched. And I don't mean sexually. Yeah. I mean in a broader sense. So, I
intimacy.
There is, it's dialectical. You won't be surprised to know.
Definitely. And I really am interested in this idea of frisson as well that you've talked about, and how the sort of over-familiarity between the sexes is sort of lessening the frisson, especially because for most of human history, men and women have like worked in separate domains.
Exactly.
And this is there's a certain thing that Pahlia says that I really like, where she says, that people should rebel against nature, but when you do, there are always consequences, and you should be ready to mitigate those consequences. And, you know, taking human beings out of their context of sort of having split sex work environments, that has created, even though I'm not opposed to that at all, you can't deny that it has created issues that we're yet to mitigate. And especially because of this sort of liberal left mode and its narcissism, there's this arrogance when it comes to like addressing these questions of human nature that's like very corrosive. Mm-hmm. And yeah, not only has it affected the relationships between men and women, because like you said, we're too familiar with one another, we're sort of melding into like this like agender thing. And it's also affected the relationships between women and other women as well. We used to work in a lot more close proximity with one another. We had our own society going on, our own traditions going on. And now that that has been, you know, uprooted and displaced, the relationships that women have with one another are incredibly contentious, and only getting more so exacerbated by the internet. I know so many women who say they have absolutely no female friends. I've gone through a lot of ups and downs in my life when it comes to female friendships as well. It's very common for women to sort of avoid each other. And it's because we're no longer useful to one another. We're just sort of competitors with each other on the sexual marketplace. And with a lot of the female friendships I had when I was like in my early 20s, I'm in my like late 20s now, but in my early 20s, there was that underlying tension of competition on the sexual marketplace that sort of had this very kind of ugly essence to it, because we weren't really useful or dependent or interdependent on each other for anything other than the fact that we just so happen to have an affinity for one another. But affinity isn't enough to hold social bonds together, which is a thing that I think people forget in modernity. Affinity simply isn't enough. You need actual cultures, economic systems, all kinds of things in order to support and to facilitate social bonds. And because our material conditions have changed, that's like created these changes in our relations between the same sex, between the opposite sexes, and that there's been very little done to mitigate these problems. What are your thoughts on this phenomenon in terms of relationships between men and women breaking down because of our close proximity, and also women's relationships being assailed by the separation that we now all experience?
Yeah, no, that was a brilliant account, and also quite, you know, tragic what you're saying. And I think part of the broader problem, I mean, several things, one of which I think is this lack of social roles, you know. So like you're saying, you know, okay, so previously maybe there were kind of roles that were attendant on sex in a way, like that there were separate spheres. This is an argument that Ivan Illich, one of my favourite thinkers, makes in his book on gender from 1982, which got him very cancelled by feminists at the time. They accused him of traditionalism and so on, and being reactionary. But I think one of the things that the sort of contemporary fake left seems to accept is like that modernity is the only game in town. And you can sort of get that out of Marx if you read it a particular way. Like there's a sort of techno-Marx, but there's also a Marx that does have an understanding of nature as well. So I'm obviously much more on the side of the humanist, like environmental Marx, that does think that sex is real, nature exists, and that men and women are different, and that, you know, how to put it, like that also means that our social bonds and precisely the forms of relationality that you clearly say are lacking, when there's only intersexual competition, for example, like you're saying, like in, you know, close female friendships based on, like you say, affinity, but not on relationality and bonds, right? So there's no loyalty, there's no looking after one another's children. They're simply like, oh, you're in a group, maybe you met at university, and you're sort of forced to be in competition for reasons that you don't really know, for men that you probably don't want to sleep with, and they probably don't really want to sleep with you, but that's what you're supposed to do. So there's just kind of confusion all around. I think one of the good things about getting older is that you start to have a lot more interesting different kinds of relationships with people that are not based fundamentally on sexual attraction or competition, you know, that you, and maybe it's partly mm-hmm. about being kind of post-sexual in some ways, or if, you know, I don't know if you're in a long-term relationship or something, I don't know how to put it, like you're just more of a person, it's not that you're not potentially a sexual person, but you're first and foremost something else, like you're what you do, you're your interests, yeah, you're mm-hmm, a character. Mm-hmm, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. we used to talk about personality, like people used to be, you know, have individual personalities before they had identity, like no one had an identity.
Long dead.
Like, I mean, every, you know, like what happened to existentialism, yeah. man? Like, you know, I mean, this whole idea that you ever are something. Yeah, I mean, is this a psychotic position? You know, everyone's in a process of becoming, you know, I'm not the same person I was yesterday. I'm certainly not. I don't have the same views I have when I was 4 years old. It would be demented. You know, so like we're not complete.
Exactly.
And we don't actually have an identity. What we have are relations, you know.
Exactly.
And we're nothing without those relations. So. Yeah, so I think what happens, at least in my experience,
Definitely.
As I've gotten older, my relationships with other women have become much more interesting and much more witchy, actually. Like, if you have a group of women on their own, it isn't a kind of, you know, and there's no man and there's no competition, and or, I don't know, like, maybe some of the women are gay or maybe some are not, you know. Let's say that isn't an issue. The intersexual competition thing isn't an issue. It can be very, very interesting from an almost like hive mind point of view. And it's a different kind of communication. Mm-hmm. It's not the same way of speaking that one engages in mixed company or in professional contexts, or, you know, the dominant way of speaking is, in a weird way, a sort of legalistic one. You know, when we walk around the world and we have interactions, they are sort of bound by social norms, whether they're explicit mm-hmm. or implicit, if you see what I mean. And there's a way of speaking and mm-hmm. being that we sort of understand. Of course, we get it wrong sometimes. But there are other forms of communication that exist, which are quite hard to talk about. And I think they're hard to talk about for
exactly.
a good reason, because they don't fit in with that general normative language that we all use.
Definitely.
So I
definitely.
Say it gets better.
And I mean, we're now kind of in a yes. And we're now kind of in a post Me Too climate as well. The famed Amber Heard and Johnny Depp case that has been going on also sort of brought screeching to the forefront a lot of the tensions that exists between men and women currently since the Me Too era. And it was sort of almost like a Rorschach test that people were projecting a lot onto during the time where the trial was happening. And I wrote an article about, an opinion piece about it for Newsweek, which blew up weirdly. And I was getting messages from liberal, it was a critique of liberal feminism and sort of it's like a, you know, it's the moral cover that it's been hiding behind. And I was getting messages from like liberal academics who I know who are like names that are out there. And they were saying stuff to me like, oh, I've been afraid to say this, or it's a trend that I've noticed, but haven't had the words. And it scares me. It just scared me how intellectually constrained the people who are otherwise smart, otherwise, you know, brilliant have become when it comes to challenging these specific modes, and also allowing them to flourish underhandedly. Like a lot of the people who are now sort of coming out against these trends are themselves responsible for like allowing them to either slip by unnoticed or not challenging them when they had the opportunities to, basically. So it's like kind of too little too late, if you know what I mean. I thought the trial was sort of a prime example again of this tension coming to like the forefront of culture. I wonder what your thoughts on the trial were, if you had any thoughts on it or if you were following what was going on.
I sort of didn't follow all of it, so I mean, I think yeah, there may be several things going on. I mean, I won't talk about the trial specifically, but I think maybe some of what's going on there is, I mean, in the first place, it's very difficult to know exactly what goes on in an intimate relationship between two people, right?
Of course,
and
I agree
about the Rorschach test. I think the polarization in the response seemed, you know, very, very extreme on both sides. Secondly, I think it's very important, again, for the reasons already stated about what freedom and what feminism actually is. It's very important that women are capable of lying, right? And that we admit that.
Yes.
You know, because women are speaking beings, and you know, as speaking beings, as rational moral agents, we are capable of saying things that aren't true. We are capable of being manipulative. We are capable of exaggeration and all of these things, right? Otherwise, we're not human. If you see what I mean. So it's very important that
we're capable.
I was just going to say we're capable of antisocial behavior just like anyone else. And there's such a thing as antisocial women. And it seems as if a lot of antisocial women or women with antisocial proclivities are drawn to this like form of like liberal feminism because they're able to use it as a moral cover for their own like psychic baggage or their interpersonal like hostilities or their just lack of ability to be pro-social or engage in pro-social behavior activities. There's this idea that only men are capable of being antisocial, but women also, we have our own form of antisocial behavior too. It may not manifest in the same way as men's do. And I thought it was really interesting that Amber Heard's diagnosis was talked about during the trial, and she was diagnosed as a borderline and a histrionic, two aspects of female antisocial kind of like behavior, if you know what I mean. And I think that these go overlooked. People don't even think that it's possible for the devouring mother archetype to exist or for there to be like antisocial elements of like the female psyche. All they see is like the sort of either the perfect mother archetype or the wife archetype or the girlfriend archetype, these sort of positive, innocent archetypes. Female darkness is really, really unexplored. What do you think about that?
No, definitely. I agree that it's partly to do with responsibility. So it's like responsibility is also like taking responsibility for your shit, right? It's like, you know, it's hard to do, right? Being a mature adult and trying to integrate all of the horror and the goodness that everybody possesses, right? Like accepting that we are flawed and ambivalent and we've all done and said fucking stupid stuff, right? And you know, everybody's made mistakes. Most people have had at least one bad relationship, right, in which both parties have behaved not well, let's say. You know, it's not to discount situations where there are extreme forms of violence or anything like that, but it's like to say something that a lot of what was being counted as Me Too was people looking back at relationships and instead of saying we both behaved badly or it was just a bad relationship and it brought out the worst in us, it was some women in particular wanting to say, no, it was an abusive relationship and I was the victim and that it was completely like asymmetrical and one-sided. And in some cases, you just know that's not true. You know, you just know that it was a bad relationship that maybe people regretted being part of, you know, and that's a fact of life. Mm. And, you know, I agree that they're basically sometimes this rhetoric of victimhood is being used often by people who are trying to get ahead in their jobs. You know, I know of people who were accused of, you know, various things, not because they were true, they weren't true, but because the person accusing them wanted the person to lose their job so that they could have their job, you know? Like, so some of this rhetoric is being used literally as a kind of economic strategy of competition, precisely as we've already said, because everyone, especially the younger people have borrowed so much money and the stakes are so high and there's so few jobs that people are basically thinking, well, anything I can use to get ahead, you know, even if it means lying about people and destroying their reputations or eliminating any ambiguity that is the real stuff of social life. And obviously we've seen that ramped up to the nth degree in terms of the denunciations and you know, this kind of firestorm you know, in recent years.
I think it's completely irresponsible as well to adjudicate guilt and innocence without taking into account careerist motivations or the fact that we exist in a giant attention economy where we're incentivized to, you know, use whatever we can to our disposal in order to attract attention to ourselves. I mean, there was a famous case in the UK that was quite funny that involved Big Brother a couple of years back. There was a contestant on Big Brother who claimed that one of the male house members assaulted her physically. And there was obviously, because it's Big Brother and it's this like crazy surveillance like experiment, there are obviously cameras everywhere. And he sort of playfully like shoved her or whatever. And it was intended as play. There was absolutely nothing hostile about it. But she blew it completely out of proportion to the point it became this huge news story. And then she was like sort of shamed after she exited the Big Brother house because everyone saw what happened. And it was quite clear that she was using this accusation as like an opportunity to aggrandize herself. And even after that was made obvious, she still didn't take accountability for it. As you see now with Amber Heard, she's still refusing to take accountability for the fact that she was the op-ed that she penned along with the ACLU was ruled as defamatory by a court of law. She's still sort of dodging those things. And I guess the larger sort of liberal feminist conversation surrounding these events has sort of been to deny or deflect or to minimize. And whenever cases like this happen, whether it be to do with race or any other sort of thing, where something that's inconvenient to the current narrative happens and is public and sort of brings it to public consciousness, there's this weird thing where these activist constituencies, particularly feminists, attempt to distance themselves from the culture that they're responsible for creating. You were the ones that were screaming, believe all women, and sort of made it this like mandatory social edict. You were the people who were demonizing anyone who even dared to ask questions. People have lost their jobs, their livelihoods, they've lost prestige, they've lost so much over these things. And it seems now that this case has sort of come to a head, there's a lot of backtracking going on in terms of how this motive, and that was why I was so surprised when my article came out and I was getting messages from like liberal media people. And it's like, you guys are responsible for this. Like, why are you coming to me? I'm just like a dumb shit poster on the internet. Like, what are you coming to me for?
You know what they're doing. I know what they're doing. They're confessing. This is like a religious gesture. What they're doing is they're confessing to you in private, because they know that they're complicit, and they know that if they now spoke out and identified the mechanism, that it would come for them. Because this is what happens. The moment you say, this is what happened to me. Yep. When people started cancelling each other, and I was like, we shouldn't be doing this. This is like not, you know, comradely. And the moment you identify that machinery, you know you're next, right? And so I think what they do, they feel guilty. They know that they were complicit. And they're trying to assuage their guilt by confessing to somebody in private, you know, who has the courage to say what they think they can't. No, seriously, because especially if they're in liberal institutions like the university and whatnot, it would still be very controversial for someone to say what you're saying, right? Because those institutions are so captured.
It's crazy to me. Yeah, it's crazy to me. And it's also, it's like Freudian. It's like, why are you turning like the DMs of some rando columnist podcaster into like your weird like Catholic confession booth? Like, it's really sick. It's really sick stuff. But then at the same time, you and I have been through the baptism by fire that is disengaging from the liberal left. So I think we've developed calluses and have sort of developed the sort of character traits it takes to like sort of not care about how one is perceived. But these people, even though on a deep level agree with the criticisms, they're still upholding this bullshit, even though they don't have to. And I think you're 100% right. It's because they know that if they try, then they could possibly be in the hot seat. But again, you and I have also lost a lot. I remember watching an interview of yours where you were saying that you had lost jobs, lost friends. I've also had the same thing happen to me. But you have to be willing to let go of stuff sometimes. I mean, as callous as it sounds, for your principles. And I think that there just aren't enough people around who are doing that. I mean, there are lots of people who are doing that, which is good. But like the people who actually have the sort of institutional power that could make a difference are just sort of like sitting on their hands.
Yeah. No, I agree with that analysis. And I think, you know, sometimes people say it's like, oh, there are 10 or 20% of people who will speak out. And then there are about, you know, 70 to 80% of people just go with whatever's going on. And then there's a smaller percentage of people who take advantage of the situation to enact, you know, sadistic and bullying things. So, you know, you're never necessarily going to have that, you know, everybody going, hang on a minute, standing up and going, like, something's going wrong here. Can we pause a minute before we, you know, I don't know, lose people their jobs or whatever. I don't know how to put it. It's, I think in every regime, this is kind of how it is, until the regime becomes so untenable that the whole thing just sort of falls apart, you know, and then everyone will pretend that they falls were always, apart.
Yep.
You know, that they were always on the right side of history, which, by the way, is a horrific phrase used by people who spend their whole time bullying people. As if, I mean, the arrogance of this phrase, by the way, like, I mean, it's just absolutely insane. But there is a great freedom, and it is like a spiritual freedom. And I read your interview with I can't pronounce his name, Wildermuth, the
Reed Godson. Wildermuth, Reed from Gods and Radicals.
And we should talk about some of these things and. I think probably our experiences are sort of similar in some ways, you know, in terms of this, like you say, baptism of fire or going through a certain process in order to come out, I don't know, like maybe more yourself or, you know, at least less afraid, freer to say what you actually think, you know, and in my case, that involved leaving a lot of institutions so that people couldn't cancel me, if you see what I mean. I mean, they did I did lose work and friends, but I actually wanted to give up everything in this renunciation before people could go for the things that they thought that they could take from me, if you see what I mean. Like a preemptive.
Same. I did
burn
the same,
everything.
Same. I did the same thing. Exactly. Like with me, because I had sort of started off sort of adjacent to that liberal left scene on YouTube. I had a lot of Patreon support from that kind of constituency, but as soon as I started singing a different tune, they all left and they all ran away or whatever. But I wasn't losing sleep because I was like, it's better to be intellectually unconstrained than to try to appeal to a demographic. And because I came up in this sort of YouTube scene and like podcasts, there's this a tremendous amount of pressure. So even though it's not institutional pressure like in academia, it's more of like a business pressure to appeal to a demographic and to please that demographic and to never piss off that demographic and to never be seen as like going against anything that demographic, you know, claims as its like proclivity. And I just said, fuck it, sod it, like, you know, sod it all, like fucking burn it down. And because of that, new opportunities arose, but it took a while and it takes a tremendous amount of bravery. And I'm not trying to pat us on the back. Well, we deserve a pat on the back. Fuck it. I'm going to pat us on the back. it does take a tremendous amount of bravery to say fuck off and to say no. And I feel like, that's the reason why they're using people like us, like our DMs, as like their like Catholic confession booth, because really and truly on an unconscious level, they know that they don't have what it takes to challenge things in a very forthright way. But everybody has to come to things at their own time. So I don't mean that like judgmentally or anything. But part of me does, to be honest, a little bit, if I'm going to be honest.
I think next time you get these DMs, you should just cut and paste the Hail Mary and send it back to them, you know.
And send it back to them. Just like say five Hail Angie Speaks and Nina Power, I like our names together. It sounds like we should fight crime together or something. I like it. I like
I
how
know,
it sounds.
I know.
Yeah,
it's yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I agree. The name
sorry,
thing is.
Well, I was gonna.
Go on.
No, sorry, there's like a delay, so I keep interrupting you because there's like a delay. Sorry, you say what you want to say and then I'll say what I want to say.
Oh, no, I was going to say something silly about the nominative determinism. You know, like maybe there is some truth to this idea that like people and their names are like, you know. You know, I think speaks is such a good surname,
true,
isn't it?
True.
Because it's like you're speaking out, you know, you're literally speaking the truth. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. It's actually not my surname though, but I chose it because my mom sent me my baby book the other, like when I was first starting the channel. And you know how the doctor like logs the progress of like the infant, and he wrote down very articulate, speaks very well. So I chose Angie Speaks as like my like identity, I guess, because of that. And yeah, I guess I've always been like a chatterbox.
But I also wanted.
Sorry, go ahead. The delay. Sorry, my bad. The delay. Go ahead.
No. So I was going to say, like, you know, it is your name. Like, you've become your name. You know, that's so. You know, people always ask me whether my name is like made up. You know, people always think my name is like a pen name or whatever, but it actually isn't. Like, it's a really common Irish surname, and it just means poor.
Wow. Wow, I did not know that. I assumed it was like a cool like writer's name or something. But it's a very fortunate name to have as a writer, I must say.
Yes. This is true.
My real name is like really scary and like Arab and African sounding, so I didn't want to confuse people, so I just like chose the most like basic thing I could find. But Angie, that's such an assimilationist position,
how could you betray your identity?
You could have
mined it for identity points.
Oh God, I know, and that's another thing that's been like a huge problem for me on the left, was that push to mine my identity for identity points, despite being just as Western as everyone else, considering the fact that I'm like a third generation immigrant at this point. I'm also like in a long-term relationship and hope to settle down with an English guy. Everything that I am, the script that's running in my head is Western. Like, I went to Nigeria last summer for a holiday because my brother was getting married and stuff, and the 2 weeks I was there made me realize just how Western I actually am, because I'm nothing like the average Nigerian. The script that's running in their head is not the same script that's running in my head, and it's very obvious that I'm a Westerner from the moment I get off the plane. And it was that sort of realization that made me uncomfortable with a lot, that made me fully sort of grasp how uncomfortable I was on the left. Like, this sort of there's this sort of desire to other me, despite the fact that I'm not really that much different from many of the people that I'm around. Like, this idea of like, that I'm this like exotic thing. Meanwhile, I'm like, you know, grew up in London and like grew up in America and like, you know, went to high school like everyone else and have the same cultural background and script running in my mind. And it's like a three, we're talking about women and womanhood and stuff. It's like a two-tiered thing, being a black woman adjacent to the left. Like, it's almost as if you're expected to mine that for all it's worth, milk it for all it's worth, and also cast yourself as a victim constantly. But I also want to talk about men, and I specifically want to talk about men on the left, who I've had huge problems with. And there's definitely something psychological about there's a certain sort of psychological makeup that I've noticed about men on the liberal left. And anytime I've tried to talk about it, I've always gotten a lot of pushback from them. I remember doing a tweet a couple of months ago, basically saying that a lot of men on the left are secretly jealous of figures like Joe Rogan because of how comfortable those men are in their masculinity and how they're not as neurotically self-preoccupied. And I got screeched at they were mad, like these grown ass men behaving like teenage girls. Like, it was really embarrassing. And there is a pathology. And I remember in an interview I watched of you, I think it was the one you did on trigonometry, where you said that the ideology and the sort of driving force behind their philosophy, even if it's unconscious, is one that's sort of anti-life. And a lot of the disdain they express towards women, which is always covert, of course, is sort of this rage against, like, the primordial mother. Would you like to go more into that? Because I was super fascinated by that take, because I felt that take intuitively, but just didn't quite know how to articulate it.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of things to say here. Where to begin? I mean, first of all, I think it's very, very, very revealing that on the left, they, you know, compared to the right even, like, I don't know, take the British government, like, the Tories have had two female prime ministers, like, Labour, like, mm-hmm. just never have any female leaders whatsoever, let alone a prime minister. So even if they profess sort of feminist principles and so on, and I don't actually think the current Labour Party has any whatsoever. I mean, they can't even define what a woman is, let alone put one in power. So
yeah.
I think what's interesting and symptomatic about some of that, though, is this kind of erasure question. It's like, even if you speak to the most right-wing misogynistic men, they still believe that women exist. Like, they do actually think that women are a thing, and they might not like them, they might resent women, but they definitely understand that women are real. Whereas on the left, this is an absolutely bizarre thing, and you get it in parts of the socialist left where it's like, oh, we can't deal with feminism, we'll sort it out after the revolution, to be very vulgar about it. But it's like, oh, any of your concerns... And I was talking about solidarity between men and women, right, which is extremely important, right? But there is a sense in which some men on the left, like, really do think that they deserve to rule the world, and that anything that women say, if it doesn't agree with them, then those women are basically just fucking evil bitches and deserves to be kind of ostracized. And if you're not sort of sexually relevant to a man on the left, you know, if he doesn't fancy you, or if you're like disagreeing with him, you basically don't exist. And I think there's something like very, I don't know how to put it, like, homosocial about the left, which is to say, like, it's a man's world. And I think partly because of this resentment towards existence itself, like, a lot of people on the left are very sad as well, and they're very unhappy about being born, and that often translates into a kind of blame towards their mother in particular, even though it takes two to tango. You know, so there's a kind of, like I said before, that a kind of repressed resentment or envy or hate, you know, that kind of teenage thing, like, I didn't ask to be born, you know, life is terrible, and I need someone to blame, and I blame capitalism and my mother, in whichever order. It's a kind of, you know, but then I think there is a resentment of women around them as well, like, for a whole variety of reasons, which kind of culminates in this sort of, erasure of women. Like, women's problems aren't that important. Women themselves are either on my side or they're witches and should be, like, you know, cast out. And, you know, we saw this... I mean, the thing that first got me in trouble a million years ago was, like, saying, you know, I used to be a card-carrying member of the Labour Party, you know, and it's like I supported Corbyn and this kind of thing. But when I saw what was happening to the women who were raising... who were also members... I wasn't an active member, by the way. I didn't do anything. But, like, there were women in the party who were raising questions, saying, like, can we talk about these proposed changes to the Gender Recognition Act? You know, it's a big deal. This is a policy, right? I.e., this is something that we can rationally discuss as adults. And they were being interrogated and booted out of the party. And I was like, hang on. Like, this isn't how this is done. You know, even if you think that these women had unreasonable objections, which they didn't, by the way, even if you thought they did, the reasonable and political thing to do is to have a proper political discussion in public about what those disagreements are. It is not to interrogate women and then boot them out of the party, you know. And so I was really appalled by this, and I wrote something about that, and that sort of triggered the whole you know, Nina is a witch and must be burnt thing, but which many people have experienced, you know. It was something like this, but it's so I don't know, like leftist men like Owen Jones, for example, seem to have like an unbelievable problem with women, you know, like any time a woman says something to him, if he hasn't already blocked them, he, you know, it's like they don't exist in his world.
I
think there's something about that erasure, and you don't get on that on the right. There are serious problems with misogyny in parts of the right, don't get me wrong, but at the very least they do think that women exist. The left fundamentally don't think that women exist, particularly in its current incarnation. The left just
big time. And the thing is, it's not old school right wing misogyny I can deal with. Like, we've had hundreds of years, thousands of years, whatever, to know how that operates. This new iteration of misogyny that you see on the left, in my mind, has the potential to be far more pernicious and corrosive because it has a moral cover. And for me, what in terms of what I've experienced, that's been the case. They've gotten away with saying and behaving in the worst ways towards me. Both mixture, it's like a mixtures of misogyny and racism. I've experienced far more of that on the left than I have with anyone on the right. In fact, I've received very minimal of that from people on the right. The vast majority I've received has been from leftist men, especially those who attempt to behave in more traditionally feminine ways. So, for instance, men, biological males who identify as non-binary, tend to use that as a moral cover for misogyny, in my experience. Whenever I've encountered men who identify that way and have had the opportunity to get close to them in any form or fashion, I've always experienced some form of misogyny that's then sort of hush-hush or poo-pooed away because non-binary identity, or men who don't necessarily identify as non-binary but don't consider themselves traditional alpha males, misogynistic, what's it called, like chest-beating chads or whatever, they tend to be even worse than the chest-beating chads because they tend to take on aspects of female antisocial behavior. Because there's such a denial of female antisocial behavior and the idea that it exists, you have women behaving in more traditionally male antisocial ways, and you now have men behaving in traditionally female antisocial ways. Things like triangulation, gossip, you know, all the different sort of things that women use to sort of police and control one another are now being employed by men. And it's the most jarring thing in the world when you encounter a 30-year-old plus man who's behaving like a bitch. It's like that's part of my issue with a lot of leftist males, and a lot of them are sort of anima possessed in the Jungian sense, in the sense that they haven't integrated their like inner femininity to make them more charismatic or more in touch with their emotions. Instead, they've repressed it, and it's come up in this really like ugly form. And it's the same with women. Women are also animus possessed. Instead of using their inner masculinity to empower themselves and to make themselves more active in the world, they've now used it to become, you know, sometimes violent, defiant, all of these things that we associate with male antisocial behavior. But with my experiences with men on the left, like you said, there's not only a deep-seated hatred of the feminine, there's also a deep-seated envy of it at the same time. And that envy comes, in my opinion, from misogyny, because what they view as femininity really isn't femininity, it's infantilization. I think they naturally see the woman as the weaker vessel that needs protection, and part of them desperately craves to be in that position where they feel like they have less responsibility, less onus placed upon them, where they're valued for superficial things like beauty or fashion rather than the work, because being a man is hard in terms of how we're socialized. Men have to prove themselves in ways that women are often, the pressure to prove ourselves isn't there. And I think a lot of men who gravitate towards the left are men who feel tired of the constraints of traditional masculinity, but instead want to employ toxic femininity as a way of escaping tradition. So it's not like an integrated, healthy femininity. It's like the infantile, unintegrated aspects of femininity that they're sort of aping as great. And it's a problem among straight men who have this issue. It's a problem among gay men as well. It's a problem among, you know, a lot of males who identify as non-binary. This sort of adopting of female antisocial behavior as like a mode of operation. And it makes a lot of people really unpleasant to be around. Like the narcissism, the triangulation, the drama, the tension, the fact that everybody's capricious, nobody has any loyalty. Everything feels like you're in a fucking like high school cafeteria with like a bunch of, and the thing is female antisocial behavior, you're supposed to outgrow that. Like, not to say that I don't have aspects of myself, of me, that those things in myself, but like that stuff that I learned to outgrow as I became a woman, because a woman is a real thing and a woman exists. But these different constituencies are putting forward this very infantile and undeveloped version of femininity as like the ultimate brand of femininity. You also see it in the way that teen angst is fetishized as well. In the way that the sort of Tumblr image of womanhood is put forward, in the obsession with looks and fashion, like among a lot of these men, like it's almost as if they're morphing into like Regina George's, I guess. What do you think of this phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, I think in all seriousness, like in my book, you know, I was trying to say. Partly, you know, one of the reasons, let's say that one of the undercurrents in the book that I don't state necessarily so explicitly, but one of the things that is, I hope, implied by what I'm saying in a serious way, although playful at the same time, is that it must be possible for men to be good. And part of the reason I'm saying that is because of this, in a sense, at least understandable, like you're saying, everything you're describing, right? Some men going, I don't want to be part of this, right? How do I get out of it? And it's partly because the general culture is saying men are bad, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So if someone is telling you, like, you belong to a group of people who are entirely bad, mm-hmm, on some deep ontological level that you can never escape, mm-hmm, it's like, of course, some of those people might go, well, I'm not one of those, mm-hmm, then, because that's bad and I don't want to be bad. Yeah. I want to be good. But rather than that, which I agree manifests itself in reality in these forms of pathological non-integrated behavior, whatever you want to say, which also draw upon stereotypes which are damaging then to women again, you know.
Big time.
But rather to say, you know, another solution to this problem, rather than trying to exit a category which you can't actually exit, is to reframe how we think about that group of men, you know, and say, men can be good. Men are already good.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a particular kind of man in order to be a good man.
Yeah.
You know, and the narrowness of these demands that people feel are coming from the culture, you can take control of them. You don't have to either fully embrace them or fully reject them.
Yep.
You can say, I qua individual man, I'm interested in these things. I want these forms, these strengths and these virtues. I'm interested in these, you know, do you see what I mean? So, so that I was trying to propose a sort of solution to some of these tendencies, because I agree that in practice they are actually more misogynistic than even, I don't know, like an average man just being blokey.
Yeah.
You know, I would prefer just some, you know, random man being a bit blokey.
Yeah.
And you know, being playful with it or whatever, and funny or not even self-aware, than someone who is so hyper-aware and hypersensitive of not wanting to be included in a group that the liberal media has said is bad, that they would, you know, as you say, embrace these, you know, stereotypes and these fantasies and these images which are also drawn from the internet and not really from real life, because the moment you encounter real people you're like, well, this
apart.
Isn't actually course, because no woman or man in real life is a pure stereotype.
No.
You know, like, we're all a mixture,
and that's my major issue with the whole like non-binary label, is that there's sort of this subtle implication that if one doesn't want to be stereotyped by the sort of typical gender stereotypes that we all have, that then that means that one is not a man or a woman. Like, there are loads of women historically that didn't want to be constrained by their gender roles, but they were still women. Like, I remember the official feminist account on Instagram a while back posted this thing where it said that Joan of Arc was a non-binary icon. And I was just like, really? Like why can't she just be a woman? Because she decided that she was going to stand up and wear a fucking suit of arms and fight and, you know, fight for her beliefs. Does that mean that any woman who does that automatically ceases to be a woman? And you know, if you think that, then what do you think about women? There's all kinds of rampant misogyny on the left, on this new iteration of the left, that goes unquestioned. And whenever any woman does try to question it, they're met with the most intense vitriol. And I guess it's part of the reason why I've stayed out of the gender debate, because I challenge a lot of liberal left norms already when it comes to race and when it comes to certain political things and when it comes to capitalism and all of these different things. I didn't want to get sucked into the gender discourse that much because it seems to be almost like a discursive trap. Once a woman gets involved in that debate, that's then what she becomes known for. The label TERF then gets put on you, and then you're then forever, and then you have these crazy people that are constantly trying to chase you and stuff. But like my position is pretty clear, which is that I don't really buy it. Like, there's definite differences between men and women, and the more we suppress those differences, the more corrosive the culture will become. The more we acknowledge those differences, the easier it is for us to come to some kind of symbiosis once again. And that's kind of my theory, and what I hope for is for people to understand the symbiotic nature of sex and how the sexes have worked symbiotically throughout all of history to ensure the sustaining of life and of culture and of all of those different things. And each sex has its downsides. Each sex has its antisocial aspects. There's no innocent party when it comes to... and of course, we can say men have had, you know, dominance in certain aspects, and there have been patriarchal systems in certain aspects, and we have to work together in order to combat that. But we also have to be humble about how we address our nature, because if we're not humble when it comes to those questions, then all we're gonna do is exacerbate the issues. And yeah, this denial of female antisocial behavior not only allows the Amber Heards of the world to flourish, it also allows a lot of men who see that as like a viable way of laundering their antisocial baggage to get away with it too. And yeah, that's what I see. I see a lot of men who are, like you said, have these sorts of antisocial proclivities on the left who are like, yay, this is a winning jackpot ticket. All I have to do is like act like a woman and no one will ever reproach me for my behavior.
Yeah, but if you're a woman and you behave like that, they will, right? So yeah. It's like a get out of jail free card, like you say. And I mean, on the non-binary thing, it's like everybody's non-binary, right? To the extent that nobody's a pure cliche of male or female, right? Yeah. So even the most masculine man might enjoy something that women like or whatever, you know. And by the way, like this shit is new, right? I grew up in the 90s, the 80s and 90s. None of this was happening. Like, nobody talked like this. Nobody had any of the... I wore, quote-unquote, men's clothes until I was 23, and literally no one ever commented on it. Mm-hmm. No one said anything. It was simply not an issue for anybody, including men I went out with or my parents. And nobody ever said to me, oh, you like doing men, you know, things that boys enjoy, and you're doing a masculine subject and you're wearing men's clothes. Don't you think you're a man? Like, that would have been absurd. If someone had said that to you in the 90s, you'd have been like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah, and like, also that's sexist as well.
Like, of course, exactly. Like, as you say, with the Joan of Arc, or women who have been, quote-unquote, gender non-conforming in history, or worn men's clothes or done things, you know, it's because they wanted to. Yeah. They're still women. You know, it's so regressive. I mean, this is the thing. Progressives are pretending that this stuff is... you know, radical and progressive. It's not. It's reactionary. It's regressive. Yeah. It's like saying if you behave like this, then you must be that sex. Yeah. The whole thing about feminism was breaking out of that and saying no. For both boys and girls and men and women, it's saying no. Expand the horizons of possibility. Yeah. You can be all these different kinds of men and women. Mm-hmm. You can have all these interests. And again, that's what called being a character and having a personality and being allowed to flourish is about. Mm-hmm. You know, it was about breaking out of those stereotypes. And instead, we get them back again with a vengeance, but detached from sex, detached from reality, and presented to us as if it's the next great stage of leftism,
big time.
When it's not.
And detached And detached from social roles too. Man and woman for all of human history had like social roles attached to it and a specific sort of stake in society. And I worry for some of the people who are young now and are adopting these more experimental identities, how untethered they may feel in future because there's no sort of reference framing or social role attached to these like new identities that are popping up. And no matter how much they try to historicize them, a lot of it is like anachronistic. It's this sort of anachronistic kind of projection of these very modern concepts into past kind of areas of gender nonconformity throughout history. And I'm not against people living as they are. Like I said, like Paulia says, rebelling against nature is like, you know, the crux of evolution. I believe we should rebel against nature because it's what species do. But you got to be ready for the consequences of that and ready to mitigate the consequences of that. And if you're going to say, I'm not a man or a woman, I'm this new special thing, well, that's like a whole thing that you got to now, like, that's like a whole model of being and a model of existence that you are now responsible for creating for yourself. And that's going to be very difficult. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't, I'm not trying to shit on anyone's parade or whatever, but there's no cautiousness or humility with which these questions are examined. It's just like, yeah, free for all, gung ho, screw the consequences, screw what happens down the line.
Yeah, and just put it this way, right? If some people are allowed to define who they are and they're allowed to say, well, I'm using woman in this way to mean a constellation of things or some sort of vague, ineffable identity, and that's my right to identify how this word is being used. It's like, well, why don't we have the right to identify this word being used in a different way? Yeah. You know, like adult, female, human, right? Like, you, do you know what I mean? You can't have it both ways. You can't say, you know, I demand the right to use this concept or this term in a particular way, but no one else is allowed to do the same thing.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, no, we're allowed to disagree. Like, you know, by their own terms, if you see what I mean, it's completely contradictory.
Yeah.
You know, you can't say, well, there's only one way of defining it and it's my way. Yeah. And if you don't agree with me, then you're going to lose your job and I'm going to fucking hound you for the rest of your life. I mean, like, this is deranged behavior.
It really is. It really is. But I feel like it's starting to lose a lot of its cultural sting.
Yeah.
Specifically because so many people are speaking out against it at this point. And it's because I think at first they were sort of trying to create a false consensus. This idea that everybody who is on the right side of history buys this stuff. And if you don't, then you're just like an idiot and you're a relic and you're reactionary and you're evil. But now reality has like asserted itself and, you know, people are now freely speaking about their concerns about it, and not from a place of hatred or derision, from a place of genuine concern and from a place of, you know, open dialogue and intellectual inquiry. But it seems as if even intellectual inquiry is like discouraged. like I remember when I was on the left, whenever I would ask questions about this stuff and try to, especially to people who have these sorts of identities, I would always get such vague answers and there would always be this air of uncomfortability as if, why would you ever even question? Why would you ask? Almost as if I was doing something intrusive when I was expected at the same time, despite not fully understanding or even agreeing with it, to use the pronouns and to bow down to the social cues and the edicts just out of general politeness, which I still do because I don't want beef with anyone and I'm not looking to rain on anyone's parade. But at the same time, I do appreciate that now it's a lot easier to be open about this stuff. What have been, just out of curiosity, what have been your experiences in terms of addressing these issues in academia? Did you have any run-ins and how did you deal with it?
No, it's interesting. I'm just thinking back to some things you're saying, and it's, you know, you've emphasized, and I agree with you, this thing about humility and intellectual humility and, you know, the fact that kind of everybody gets things wrong, everybody's changed their mind, everybody's made mistakes, you know, that's a kind of part of being human. And there's this sort of absolutely punitive, unforgiving quality. And I agree with you that I think it's absolutely untenable. And I think the older people get, the more they realise that life is quite grey a lot of the time, and that lots of things we think are settled or not, and that we actually refine our position in the wake of new thinking and new questions and new information. You know, that's also what it is to be human. Mm-hmm. And it's important. Otherwise, what we're just going to repeat the same words to each other over and over again, and everyone has to think the same, then there wouldn't be any conversations.
Exactly.
So, yeah, and I think this relates to the academia question, because I think that, you know, like all institutions, and I'm very anti-institutions, right? I'm a big fan of Illich, and I think he's absolutely correct that basically what happens with all institutions is they start off really well. They have a great idea. They're very positive. You know, like, let's say medicine is about healing people, right? Yay! You know, it ends up, like, fucking damaging and killing them, right? Mm-hmm, education is about opening people's minds and getting them to think, and it ends up imprisoning and indoctrinating them, right? Mm-hmm, so he has this great phrase. He says, like, the corruption of the best is the worst, right? And he says that in modernity, this is what happens to all of these great institutions, including the church, you know, and he's Catholic, subversive Catholic. And it's absolutely kind of fascinating, right? Like, what happens there? There's something about the institution. Human beings are the institution, but they also become institutionalized, that they end up defending things and doing things that actually run against their own moral temperament, you know, their own moral character. And I think academia has been kind of captured, like everything else, by a certain ideology and a certain fear. And as I said, like, I was a lecturer for 13 years, and I was always writing on the side. I had a blog in the blog days, and, you know, I had another sort of life outside of it. And I increasingly felt so alienated from the institution, not because where I was working was particularly bad. In fact, it wasn't. It was kind of slower than some places. It wasn't, you know, an online, you know, it didn't have that kind of immediate terrified responsiveness of some of the more elite universities. Mm-hmm, you know, most of the students were local, working class, you know, lots of different backgrounds, some religious. You know, none of this was coming from the students, right? I liked the students a lot, and a lot of them were struggling with trying to stay employed, you know, have jobs whilst also going to university, in some cases having families. You know, the sheer amount of debt, anxiety, you know, seminars became very difficult because people were just too anxious to speak. You know, they're worried about saying the wrong thing, which is very difficult when you're teaching philosophy, because in a way you have to try out arguments and you have to make mistakes, and it's part of it. And so that was getting kind of sadder and sadder, because the students were themselves inhibited for all these economic and material reasons. And at the same time, the kind of bureaucracy and the centralization and the ideology of the some of the staff and the kind of admin thing, not the women who worked in the office, not the kind of secretaries who actually did all of the work, but the way in which academics took on this role as sort of police in some ways, and like policing the ideology and becoming very bureaucratic. And I just couldn't do it. I couldn't be there anymore. And I was starting to get pushback for saying this thing about the Labour Party, and you know, these deranged sociopathic people started coming after me and writing to everybody and telling them I was an evil fascist bitch and whatever, and everything I'd ever said and done was wrong and I should lose all my work. And they weren't yet coming for my jobs at the university. But when I went back to pick up my stuff, someone had, like, trashed my name, like, vandalised my name. And, like, they covered it with no transphobia here and, like, fuck TERFs and, you know, this kind of graffiti. And it's very obviously directed, you know, at my name on the board and then on my door. And what really hurt me about that was less the stuff, because I just thought, okay, like, a couple of student activists or something has, like, come read a Twitter thread and someone said, oh, Nina Power is a, you know, TERF, whatever. But was what made me sad about that was the fact that none of my colleagues had taken the stickers down, and none of them had told me, you know, none of them had taken the action to get rid of those, that graffiti and this.
Wow.
Do you see what I mean? Because that's what, you know, and I had no idea how long that stuff had been up, like the stickers and the graffiti. It's like, but they would have walked past that, like, on a daily basis. And what did they not see it? Did they not, notice? Did they think, oh, if I get seen taking this down, will I too be tarred with this terrible brush of being an evil person? You know, and that made me really scared, actually, and like a bit frightened, you know, that people I'd work with for more than a decade, like, didn't notice or didn't care or didn't think, oh, hang on, I should take this down.
Wow, that is so treacherous. That's so dark. But it doesn't surprise me at the same time either.
I know, right?
That's so treacherous. But also, I would not be surprised if it was, either they felt as if... it could be one of two things. Either they felt that you deserved the quote-unquote criticism, or it's that they felt afraid, which is even worse in my opinion. They felt afraid to challenge it because they were afraid that they would be next. And I've heard so many different horror stories like this, and how despite institutions sort of claiming community ethos in order to sort of increase morale among its constituency or whatever, like you said, there is no community. There is no real tether beyond affinity and the fact that you're all within this institution. So it's incredibly easy for the sort of social environment to turn hostile. And wokeness is just sort of added gasoline onto that, like, flaw that already exists within institutions, in my opinion, because institutions are always flawed. And whenever humans are in institutions, there's always some kind of upheaval that comes from that. But I feel like wokeness has, and the reason that I'm so adamant and I talk about it so much, and despite it kind of being annoying to some certain people or whatever, is because I feel like it's created this giant avenue for antisocial behavior in our society to flourish, and antisocial proclivities to kind of go unnoticed. And I feel like it's dangerous. Not only are things getting more interpersonally hostile between men and women, they're getting interpersonally hostile between everyone. Like, one of the phrases that Christopher Lash uses that kind of sums it up is the war of all against all. Mm-hmm. And I think that the war of men and women against one another is sort of encapsulated in that war of all against all. And everywhere feels like a war of all against all now. And it seems as if that's only sort of going to escalate. What do you think about this? And also, what is your advice for surviving the war of all against all? How do you navigate these contentious environments?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that phrase is much older in a way. Like, it comes from Thomas Hobbes, you know, when he talks of... Yeah.
I didn't know that. I thought it was Christopher Lash's...
Christopher Lash is brilliant, don't get me wrong.
I felt guilty because I was like, oh, I steal from him all the time. But turns out he's stealing from... I shouldn't beat myself up so much. That's what I got to say.
No. But look, if something's true, it's true. Yeah, do you know what I mean? And human beings repeat the same things because they're true. We're interested in the same... You know, it's like, if you think about it, it's amazing. You can read a text from 2,000 years ago and you can understand what someone's talking about, right? This is incredible, right? But it tells you something about continuity and wisdom and, you know, human thought. So, you know, war of all against all is basically Thomas Hobbes, is a great English philosopher. You know, he says, he has this idea of the state of nature, and he says, like, if there was no law, if there was no government, how would we behave to one another? And he talks about, he says, man is a wolf to man, right? Homo homine lupus est in Latin, the idea that basically if there were no constraints on our behaviour, what we would do is actually become very competitive and, you know, potentially violent. We would use everything in our power, our intelligence, our strength to kind of steal resources from one another. It's a very, very bleak picture of human nature. And many people have criticised Hobbes because it's not actually... correct, right? Like, human society is often very cooperative. Like, there's been vast periods from which, you know, men and women and you know, different tribes or whatever and different groups of people have actually gotten on. Otherwise, we would never build anything. We'd never do anything, which is what Hobbes says, you know, without any cooperation and we would, there would be no industry, there'd be no art, there'd be no culture. So what he's trying to say, though, is that basically we need a power to hold us together. And he therefore sort of defends the sovereign, and he says that we give up our right to fight each other in return for the protection of the sovereign, right? So he's this first great contract theorist in the 17th century. and then, you know, Locke and Rousseau come after him. But the war of all against all is just, you know, in a way, it's a possibility of human nature, if you see what I mean. Like, it's a potential for seeing the world. Like, mm-hmm. we can see the world as either extremely competitive, which I do agree is what's being encouraged. Mm-hmm. When you're competing for jobs, when you're competing for a sexual partner, when you're competing for attention, you know, it's a Hobbesian world, right? But at the same time, we're also cooperative people. Like, sorry, I switched my light on in a very extreme way there. That most of the time, when we encounter each other, you know, our attitude is not like that. And actually, if you take as a model of human relations, let's say a mother's relationship to her child, you can't possibly give a Hobbesian account of that. Do you know what I mean? It's like the mother is not, you know, competing with her child. The mother is, like, looking after her child, hopefully. Do you see what I mean? Like, there's... So we don't mm-hmm, have to start mm-hmm, with the individual, mm-hmm. you know, potentially violent, hostile, paranoid, you know... human, right? That's not necessarily the first unit of society. So lots of people have criticised this idea. But nevertheless, as I say, it's a possibility. But I think in most of our interactions, I think on some level, we have everything we need, right? Everything that, you know, in terms of resources, in terms of our human needs, everything actually already exists. But it's just kind of obscure. It's being obscured, right, by these sort of... you know, delusional ideas, and people are making these divisive claims. I mean, this is why in the book I talk about trying to get over the zero-sum game idea, you know. So instead of thinking of mm-hmm. male-female interactions as competitive, you know, the idea that, oh, if women advance, then men lose, or if men advance, women lose, you know, which is the zero-sum game model. Instead of thinking that, we can think about actually a much more infinite and expansive set of relationships that are not competitive, that are more yeah. playful. And I think we already have those. It's also mm-hmm. about recognising in our friendships and even in our daily encounters with strangers, you know, we have a choice. We can be nice. And I don't mean in that horrible be kind poster way, right, that was... all around London during the lockdowns, yeah. but rather in the yeah. sense that we have a yeah. choice about how we behave socially. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, so we already time. Have those and also, resources.
I guess. Yeah. Yeah. I guess to an extent, the war of all against all, like you said, is something that is being incentivized among people. So regardless of whether or not you think that way, you will encounter environments that incentivize that kind of mentality. And I guess the way that I think you're right, like we get to choose our behavior. We get to choose how we interact with it. But my way, I guess, has been to do my best to avoid antisocial men and women. and I think the older you get, the better you get at spotting signs of antisocial behavior in other people and like patterns that are corrosive towards like interpersonal harmony. and we all have those patterns for sure. It's something we all have to work on within ourselves in order to be able to get on with other people. But there are some people for which those patterns are ubiquitous. I think that those are the people who are, it's almost like an evolutionary adaptation. Like now to be antisocial is to have an evolutionary advantage almost because of how much success and attention is geared towards these sorts of behaviors and these sorts of mentalities. So I think that there'll always be a tension as long as the current status quo continues for people who are not antisocial and don't want to be around antisocial people and also who want to deal with their own antisocial proclivities in a healthy way, and the entire antisocial mode that we're all forced to kind of interact in and create our careers in and to, you know, try to claim a stake in. It's a very difficult balance, but I don't think it's impossible. And that's what I really like about your book and your work in general, is that you're attempting to create a synthesis, which is also what I hope to try and do as well, a synthesis between these opposing or seemingly opposing forces, and I don't see things as in opposition in the same way that you don't. I see things as in this sort of symbiotic way, and I think things behave best when they behave when they're sort of working in symbiosis with their opposite. I think there's nothing more beautiful in nature, I wish more people would open their eyes to that. But I guess to round out, since I've kept you for quite a long time, I wanted to ask, what advice do you have for younger women specifically in terms of having healthier interpersonal relationships with men?
I suppose,
a big question.
Yeah. No, it's a really important question. I think, in the first place, to understand that this culture, this, and especially the kind of hypersexualized competitive aspects, is damaging to both men and women, right? To understand that, like, it's not correct exactly to blame men as a class for whatever lack or deficiency or upset that women perceive, right? So even where there is, it's obviously important, as you say, to recognise genuine patterns of antisocial behaviour, you know, in ourselves and in others, and, you know, to step away, you know, where that's possible to do so. It's hard if it's members of your family, but then there are questions of, like, tough love and how you actually help somebody, right? Which isn't just going along with their pathology or rewarding it, certainly not, right? So I think, in the first place, to understand that both men and women are here almost in an absurd way. Like, you know, we don't ground ourselves. We don't choose when we're born. We don't choose, like, our sex. We don't choose, like, you know, our parents and stuff like that, right? So there's loads of things about our own lives which we are not the authors of. And, you know, and if you believe in gods, then, you know, ultimately we're not the authors of anything at all in that sense. You know, we're creatures, and as such, we're kind of flawed, and we, you know, we're all broken. And so I think to go in with an attitude, like you say, of humility, and you really stress this word, and I totally agree with you, intellectual humility, social humility, personal humility, but also kind of forgiveness of others, like being prepared to say, okay, you know, look, you upset me about this, or this was wrong, or this relationship was bad in these ways, you know, but also to kind of go, well, yeah, that's life, right? There is suffering, there will be harm, we will all cause harm, right? It's not the preserve of one group and not the other, right? This is the problem with a kind of pure victim system, you know, the idea that there are some groups who can't cause harm, right? It's just not true. Every human being, by virtue of being human, is capable of harm.
As a black person, I definitely... Yeah. As a black person, I definitely have been familiar with that pathology of, like, oh, black people are these, like, innocent, like, almost primordial beings, which is complete horseshit.
No, also, can I just say that's, like, intensely racist. Like, you know, a lot of this neo-leftist woke stuff is it's just essentialist, like, horribleness, you know, whether it's about men or women. Yeah. You know, that's why it's, like, getting back to expanding the existential possibilities that was the progressive moment, you know. It was like saying getting rid of these, you know, essentialist categories, not reifying them and bringing them back and then pretending that it's good, like, so I think for young women and young, you know, young men, I think also to get away from, like, environments that are explicitly sexualized, you know, like nightclubs and, you know, whatever. I mean, maybe they're not so much always, but I suppose it's like taking the heat out of that encounter. Like, there are so many interesting things, like if you do evening classes or go to church, or do you know what I mean, like actually become involved in, like, community gardens, and, you know, and I think you're much more likely, one is much more likely to meet interesting people that way, you know. So it's this, the pressure is not so, you know, on the dating app, the pressure, the spectre of sex is always there, right? Or the possible relationship, whereas I think if you encounter people organically, like in your local area, it's, you know, the possibilities are much nicer, much gentler, you know, much more playful. So I think it would be to And also not to worry. I mean, it's not the world's most important thing always to be in a relationship as well. Like, sometimes it's actually quite good to be on your own and to actually be able to cope with that and to be like, yeah, actually, you know what? I might like to be with someone, but I can also live with being on my own. Yeah. You know, I've been on my own for a period. I have a partner now, but, you know, there was a while and I didn't. And there was a very... you know, some very interesting things happen, you know, when you spend time with yourself and, and you know, on it's actually own. Like, really, like you can become very strong in some ways and very, it's a very interesting thing to do. So I think, just to take the pressure out of it, you know, and not, people should be much kinder to themselves, you know, not, you know, you don't have to solve everything and fix everything, especially not if you're in your 20s. You know, it's just like read some books and hang out with your friends and go to parks and, you know, it's all good.
Big time. Big time. And I same here. I've been in a relationship now for the last 7 years and I'm relatively young and I'm like a serial monogamist or whatever. So I've been in like, I haven't had very... many periods of singlehood or whatever, but it just so happens that I met someone that I was very compatible with, like at a young age, and I saw the difference between how I talk about men and how a lot of my female friends who are single talk about men, who are on dating apps and things like that, talk about men. I can't afford to hate men because I live with a man and have for a very long time, and he's also somebody that I love and that I consider part of me. I consider him my family. Whereas, like, when you're atomized and you're sort of in the sort of commodified feedback loop of, like, dating apps and you're engaging in self-commodification and being commodified by other people, that the interactions you're going to have are naturally going to be more negative. And a lot of the women I know who have, like, been in that whole sort of milieu have, like, developed a lot of bad perceptions of men and don't believe it's possible to have a good relationship, or that men, they've almost lost hope. It's this form of like nihilistic cynicism that is unbecoming of such young women, and it's upsetting to see a lot of the time. And then there's also this like weird thing where they project, where some of my friends that I've had in the past have projected onto my relationship of like, oh, there must be some kind of skeleton in the closet there. You two couldn't possibly be happy together. He must be some kind of monster. Or where my boyfriend will do like a typical bloke behavior. And then I'll have a female friend like pull me aside and be like, is he abusive? Or I perceive that behavior to like be abusive or whatever. And it got to the point where I had to keep a lot of those female friends away from my relationship. I had to sort of like stop hanging out with them, with my boyfriend, or just sort of erect boundaries because of how corrosive it was starting to be towards like my self-perception, and also my partner feeling like he was under scrutiny constantly when he was around these women. There is this real, and same thing for men, like there's a lot of bitterness and toxicity towards men who have also who feel either as if they are unable to compete on this in the sexual marketplace, and a lot of the time this is because they're looking at it as a marketplace. They're not putting themselves in situations where serendipity can take its natural course.
Yeah, that's a great word.
It's very contrived. Yeah. Like serendipity exists, and if you give yourself to it, you will find what you're looking for. And I feel like because everything is so digitized now, a lot of people, yeah, they forget that serendipity is possible, and that if you put yourself out there, you might be able to find somebody who you're compatible with. It's possible. I met my partner in university because I wanted to start a band, and he was a producer, and we've been together ever since. Like, we didn't even start off even thinking anything romantic. We were friends for a whole year before we even became intimate with each other. And it, of course, it doesn't work that way for everybody, but there's something beautiful about opening oneself up to serendipity. And I think there's something really sad about how the digital environment has taken away opportunities for serendipity, and has told people that these sort of algorithmic patterns are true serendipity, when it's not. It's like a company attempting to play God, and you allowing a company to play God over your life. It's sad. It's really, really sad. But yeah, I'm definitely very anti-dating app, but I also have a partner, so I know it's easy for me to say that. Like, if I was single, maybe I would be on the dating apps, because it's difficult these days. The dating game sounds hostile, in all honesty. It sounds like it's steeped in a lot of hostility.
But that's why I think just doing these other things, like going to evening classes and learning a new skill and, you know, being involved in other things where you will meet other people. Like, that's why I think going a circuitous route, and I totally agree about serendipity, and I think, you know, sometimes when people think they'll never meet somebody, they kind of randomly do, and it is like serendipitous. It's like, if that's mm-hmm. what people want, maybe it takes a while, you know. And I think, yeah, like forcing it through the technium is like a bad magic.
bad idea. Well, thank you so much, Nina, for coming. This is one of my favorite conversations I've had in a while, and I really appreciate you giving me the time. Would you like to let everyone know where they can find you? Also, plug the book. Everyone needs to go read it. Go ahead.
Sure, yeah. Like, I recorded an audiobook of it, like, in my own voice as well. So if you I don't have a particularly nice voice, but it's pretty funny to read your own book.
I like your voice.
So that exists. The book, yeah, is like, I don't know, available in book places. And I have a Substack, which is just ninapower.substack.com, where I write really deranged poems and prose that like isn't for anything. So it's kind of purely free associative and like very weird usually. And I write about birds a lot. And yeah, I guess that's kind of it. And if you like geopolitics and political economy and cultural criticism, then you should read Compact magazine as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you, Angie. It was very, very good to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks to everyone out in the audience. Be sure to check out everything Nina mentioned. Talk to you guys later. Bye.